Mother's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline will be back with us again next week. Our guest on Writer's Voices today is Nancy Burke, author of Only the Women Are Burning. Nancy is the author also of From the Abuela's Window and If I Could Paint the Moon Black. Her short fiction has been published in several literary journals and her short plays performed at festivals. As of this writing, her short story, At the Pool, is a finalist for the J.F. Powers Prize for Short Fiction, so maybe there'll be an update on that. Nancy earned her MFA in creative writing at Rutgers University, Newark, in fiction, with a concentration in dramatic writing. She is mother to three daughters and lives in Montclair, New Jersey, the community that inspired the setting for this book. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Nancy.
Oh, thank you so much, Monica. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. So, Only the Women Are Burning. Give us a little overview of what this story is.
Okay. Only the Women Are Burning is, I'll start out by saying it's a cross-genre book that has elements of science fiction, some fabulous elements, but it is at its core a domestic novel, a domestic women's fiction work. It is about a woman who is in middle age and lives in a town, Hillston, which, like you just said, is much like the town I live in. And she is raising three daughters, and she has a husband who is always on the road. And she has a small job at a museum, and one morning she's walking to the train station to take the train to her job, and a woman bursts into flames on the train station platform, and she tries to save the woman and can't, and gets drawn in to the mystery surrounding the event. And after she goes home, she finds out that two other women had the same thing happen to them on the same morning.
And one of them being someone that she knew well.
Yes, and yeah. She finds out later that day when the names are revealed that one of the women was her very, very dear friend who she had been estranged from for a few years. And so it brings up for her a lot of regret, a lot of recognition of how we take things for granted, take people for granted. She always thought they would reconcile, and she's upset because now she knows that they obviously never could.
It's too late.
Yeah. Too late.
So
yeah.
What was the genesis for this story? Because, you know, this isn't your normal everyday occurrence, women bursting into flame.
No, it's not a normal everyday occurrence. Thank goodness, right?
Yeah, really.
But this book started many, many years ago when I was just starting to write and I was doing a lot of journal writing. And I was sitting under a tree where I took my young children to the swimming pool in the summers. And I was writing in my journal and this imagery just found its way. Found its way through my pen and onto the page. And it just started with the women began to spontaneously ignite all over the suburban landscape. And there it was on the page. And I said, what in the world is this? And where did this come from? So I was as surprised at the idea. And then I just kind of let it mull around in my mind for a while. And I started to write it. Started it as a police procedural kind of novel. And a dear friend of mine who was a journalist said, no, 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 Nancy, you can't write a police procedural because you don't know anything about that. And he was absolutely right. And so it took a while to have the book find its form that it finally found its way to publication in. But what happened was when I got the idea, it started me on this journey of reflection about all the women I know. And I'll back up just a minute, because when I was, at first a young mom at home with three kids, I had three kids in 3 years, a three-year-old and twins, okay, who were born when she was just short of 3 years old.
Oh, my.
And life gets really intense when you have, you know, when you have your kids that close together and you are fully responsible for them because you have a spouse who's really not around, which was problematic. But anyway, I started this group in my town. It was a local chapter of a national organization called FEMALE. And the letters in FEMALE stood for Formerly Employed Mothers at Loose Ends. So it was a really, really great organization that poked a lot of fun at its own self, but still said some serious things to women who were making that transition from being professional level working women to being suddenly at home after a successful career, raising kids and letting go of that whole world that you used to be a part of and that you used to base a lot of your self-esteem on. So that social group really did create kind of a foundation for this book. The relationships that I had with the women back then were really important to me and to them because we kind of circled the wagons and said, okay, we're going to do this. And go ahead.
You know, I had never really thought about it. I'm sure a bit older than you, but and I started, you know, I got married very young, had kids very young, and worked most of the time they were young, for various reasons, mostly necessity, but also because I wanted to. Even though I was raised, you know, I came of age during a time when it wasn't necessarily expected that that mothers would be working. But then I was able to really achieve a lot of career success later in my life, which, because I started so young, my kids were grown out of the house by the time I was 40.
So you could really focus.
So I could really focus. And I never really thought about, in a way, how much, in some sense, how much easier it was to do it in that direction rather than to have the success and then leave it.
Yeah, because what happens is you lose traction and it's really, really hard to go back after you've taken a long break.
Yeah.
And I actually did that in my life. I did my MFA in creative writing at Rutgers when my twins were in their last 2 years of high school because I planned to go back to work, but I wanted to do something other than my business career that I was in prior. So, but when you have a resume that has that really, really wide gap, there, it creates a certain expectation or lack of expectation in the workplace. And I had to kind of really find my way back into a career again.
And so is novel writing your full-time career at this point?
Oh, I wish. Oh, if only. No, actually, I work, I had a business career prior to having my children, and I left because I couldn't work 60 hours a week and be on planes all over the country while I had young kids at home. So when I went back to work, I was looking at teaching. And instead of teaching, I ended up working for one of the community colleges in New Jersey, being the liaison basically between employers and the college and their employee training programs, their workforce development department, let's say. So it turned out to be a perfect combination of marketing skills and understanding of education. And so that's what I've been doing since I've been back to work, which is going on 10 years, actually.
Well, that does sound like a great fit.
Yeah, I mean, I found a woman who was a mom, who was an executive director level, who understood that you don't give up your skills when you give up your job. And if you're smart in that interim, you keep your skills strong, and so that you can step back into work. Okay.
Right. Well, smart employer actually, you know, will jump on the chance of getting that talent. You know?
Yes. Yes. And I was lucky to find one. And not everybody is lucky to find that smart employer.
Right. Right.
And that goes back to one of the central themes in the book, which is that Cassandra, who is the protagonist who witnesses this woman burst into flames, She had a previous career in as an anthropologist / geoarchaeologist and gave that up when she became pregnant and followed her husband to where he was living and working internationally. So she went through a series of, you know, of having to give up her previous work, and has, you know, in the book, her personality is she's happy where she is, but she's missing that piece of herself that kind of got put on the back burner. And so that silencing of women's voices is an undercurrent that goes on in this book, because the police and the fire department who speak with Cassandra as a witness, they dismiss her thoughts and her theories about how this could potentially be happening. And it's because she's a stay-at-home mom, and they don't know anything else about her except her current present self. And so part of the journey in the book is her finding her own credibility again and finding a way to prove to the community that she's a part of, that she's not, you know, this goes back to one of the newsletters from the female organization had a headline that said, "I had a baby, not a lobotomy." and back at the time, we all laughed, but in some parts of the world, you're accepted on your face value, and the world doesn't bother finding out what's under that surface. Where is that intellect? Where is that education that you got? And what do you know that you don't use in your everyday life? Mm-hmm. And this is kind of what Cassandra starts to find it necessary to emerge from kind of underneath that darkness.
Now, the prologue is set when she is working as an anthropologist in India, and she has an experience with a woman burning to death there. Was that, at what point did you, in writing this, did you realize that you needed to have that background to make the story work?
I have always looked at everything through an anthropologist lens, because I was an undergrad anthropology student major, basically. And when I was looking at the book and I was looking at that little excerpt that I wrote in my journal, that was the spark for the idea, I started looking at news media and online about women burning. And I kind of got into this deep research into India and dowry deaths in India, and the practice of Suthi, which is an ancient practice in the Hindu religion where women who become widowed are encouraged to throw themselves on the funeral pyre of their husband at his death and accompany their husband into the afterworld. And that, in the Hindu faith, is how they become goddesses. And so in India, I discovered this, that there are shrines that are built for these women who attain the status of goddess for having done that. It's an outlawed practice in India. But I just went into this deep dive about all the different cultural practices and all the mythology around women and fire, not only in our own culture, but in India, in in other cultures as well, in Native American. And I even looked into European fairy tales and mythology, where women and burning are paired thematically in fairy tales. I mean, in Grimm's fairy tales, Hansel and Gretel push the witch into the oven to escape the evil witch. Joan of Arc was burned at the stake. There's all this mythology all over the world about women and fire. Mm. And so I accumulated all this research, and then I had the problem of having too much for a single book. And so I had to kind of pare it back, and I had to selectively choose what was going to work in the background of Cassandra, how does she know what she knows? And she's had unique experiences that that your more traditional suburban, you know, stay-at-home mom housewife would not have had. And so she knows things in ways that other people don't know. And her journey is to bring that out so that she can solve this mystery and have people believe her.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Nancy Burke, author of Only the Women Are Burning. Well, I found the parts about what happened in India to be really interesting and also very hard to understand from a Western sensibility, where, you know, there's a mystery about how this friend of hers was actually set on fire, and it seemed like nobody wanted the police, her family, other people, women in the community, nobody wanted to look closely at it. Do you think that type of thing actually happens?
I think it does happen. There are statistics about India that list 60 million missing women in India. And
Whoa.
If you dig into the culture there, you can find all kinds of misogynistic elements within the culture. And I don't mean to bash the country of India. It's actually on my bucket list of places that I want to visit someday. And because I find it absolutely a fascinating blend of people and cultures and everything. But there are, when I was writing Only the Women Are Burning, there were articles in the New York Times that were highlighting women who were victims of burnings, who were scarred for life and were in hospital burn units because of the practice of dowry deaths, which is something that the authorities don't pay attention to. They look at it as a domestic issue in some ways. A woman is basically given to a husband as a bride by her family in India in the traditional way that a marriage works there. And with the bride comes the dowry. Now, India is like the poverty capital of the world. There are so many poor people in India that the dowry money becomes very important to the receiving family. If they get to the point where they can no longer feed their family, the wife who accompanied the dowry becomes expendable, and because she's a burden on the family. And so there are stories that are, you know, that are disputed, of course, by the family, that mother-in-laws or someone else in the family will throw kerosene on a young bride and burn her, and blame the kerosene stoves that they used for cooking for the accident that took her life.
And the benefit then is that they can go out and get another bride?
Or they don't have to feed another person.
Wow.
They don't have to support another person.
That's
and
so
maybe they
sad.
Do get a new bride.
Yeah.
It's very, very sad, and it's very, very painful. I mean, it was very painful to read this research when I was doing it. But you mentioned a little while ago that, you know, that the Western world doesn't really have the context for understanding this. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to include it in the book, because I wanted to widen our perspective. We have a women's movement in our country, which, you know, I very much believe in. But what I also do sometimes is I pause and I say, you know, if we compare our lives in the United States of America to the lives of women in other cultures all over the world, we're doing pretty darn well. And this is a really, really good way to highlight that for my readers.
Mm. I know. And yet if we try and sort of use that lens to even uplift someone, what we consider uplift women in another culture, we're often condemned for cultural imperialism. And you know, for just not understanding, and often right rejected even by the women that we're trying to help. And I don't know that there's any solution for that.
No, there isn't. I remember when I was an anthropology student at Montclair State University, which is not far from, you know, where I live. One of my professors was doing work among the women in India, and she would drive into the village on the Planned Parenthood truck. And when the women of the village would see the Planned Parenthood truck drive in, they would all flee. Because controlling how many children you have is not something that their culture would embrace.
Yeah.
Women get their status from producing children. And so it's a threat to women to think that they could prevent themselves from having children because it would diminish their status in the family.
Wow.
So you're right. There's all of this, we have our expectations. And I mention it in the book. There's a scene in the book where Cassandra goes to meet this woman in a women's center in Bangalore near the slum where she was doing her research. And the woman looks at her, and without giving away the whole scene, she just looks at her and says, "Oh, you and your American should.
Yeah.
You don't understand what binds us as a people." And it's an awakening moment for Cassandra because she realizes, as much as she is in earnest to try to, you know, do the right thing for her friend who perished, her hands are tied.
It almost seemed like her involvement in that woman's life might have contributed to the to her death.
Absolutely.
Which is
The challenge for an anthropologist is to observe a culture, but not influence the culture.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very hard thing to do for what they call the participant observer, who is, you know, somebody like a Margaret Mead who goes and observes a culture that is different from her own. Mm.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Nancy Burke, and the book we're discussing is Only the Women Are Burning. Now, there are other kind of religious elements to this story as well. One of them being kind of a correlation with a biblical verse.
Yes.
Yeah.
She, Cassandra meets a, I'm trying to remember, it's so funny sometimes you forget the details of your own book. she meets a homeless man, and he stands up and he quotes from Matthew. Or the quote in the book is, "Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and the other left." And Cassandra hears that, and she does think about her own self at that train station that morning. Why was it that woman who burned and not herself? They were both in the same place. Why did one get taken and one be spared?
Right.
And that is, you know, that is what is one of the central mysteries to the story.
Now, Cassandra,
why are some women burning?
Cassandra has quite a problematic relationship with her two sisters who live not far away. So I have to wonder, do you have sisters? And if so, what do they think of that aspect of the story?
Well, I do. I have four sisters.
Four?
I come from a family of seven, a big Irish Catholic family. I am the second out of the seven, so I'm the second oldest daughter. And I have four sisters, and we don't always get along. There are dynamics that go on in a big family that people who aren't from a big family don't really see. We have this, you know, American mythology about one big happy family.
Aren't we all the Waltons?
Exactly. The Waltons.
Yeah.
Cheaper by the Dozen is that family in Montclair from way back in the early part of the 1900s who had 12 children.
Yep.
And, you know, and it's all, you know, eight is enough. I mean, I could, you know, the Brady Bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, we can name
on
all
and
these,
on.
All these, you know, all these things. But within a family, there are dynamics, and sometimes they're not like the best for everyone. And so what I try to do is sisterhood is such an important part of a woman's life. In this book, Cassandra finds sisterhood with her mom's group because she doesn't find it with her own sisters. And it does reflect a little bit of some of the experiences I've had in my own life, exaggerated for the purposes of fiction. And, it serves to kind of highlight how important we really are to each other and how we can sometimes be unconscious of the way our behavior has impact on other people.
You know, I'm from a fairly large family too. There were five kids, and I am also the second of the five.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I have an older brother
and
two younger brothers, just one sister. So, but it is interesting to me how different sisters can be from one another. Certainly my sister and I took very, very different, paths in life. And even though we love each other and when we're together, we have a good time, we don't spend all that much time together because we have such different ways of looking at the world. Yeah. So,
yeah. I mean, I have, you know, five different women, all from the same family, and all five of us have lives that are pretty different from each other. We have different political views. You know, we live in different towns. We have different levels of education. We have different things that we, you know, just kind of do. It is amazing sometimes when you say, how did we all come from the same family?
I know. And my family, even like my older brother, you know, I was also from a Catholic family, not Irish, but Catholic. And but my older brother became a Jehovah's Witness and is very, very happy in that life. And as far as I can tell, and really only one of us, my sister, remained in the Catholic faith. And but our religious beliefs are all over the map.
That happens. My older sister and I are a year and 2 weeks apart in age. And she taught. I mean, she worked in the business world for a little while, but she always wanted to teach. So she ended up going back and teaching in a Catholic school in her town. And she has stayed within the confines of the way we were raised as Catholic children going to Catholic school. I, on the other hand, still practice as a Catholic, although my way of exercising my faith is very, very different from the way she does. Where I may, like, she may be a creationist, where I'm an evolutionist. And I'll just, you know, like, just that as a fundamental difference. And what some of the, you know,
right.
foundational conservative Catholic things that you are expected to follow as a member of that church, and a liberal wing that looks at things in a completely different way.
Well, you know, creationism was never part of the teaching of the Catholic Church when I was a child. We totally accepted evolution. It wasn't.
I know.
So I'm not even sure how that came up in becoming part of conservative Catholicism.
I don't know either, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you know, we all learned this, but why do people choose to accept that?
Yeah.
And I imagine that since she was a teacher of math and a teacher of religion at her school, she probably had to, you know, take a literal interpretation of the elements of the Bible.
But that wasn't part of Catholicism for my upbringing in it. was ones, you know, the Catholic Church wasn't the one taking the literal interpretation. But
no.
Yeah.
I know. It is fascinating how people's minds evolve.
Yeah.
And you know,
yeah.
A couple years ago I attended at Fordham University in New York City. They hosted the Catholic Literature Conference. And I was very curious. And I said, I'm going to go to this because I want to answer the question of whether I'm a Catholic writer or not. Like, what defines a Catholic writer? And there's a young man who went to the MFA program with me at Rutgers who just wrote a book. And I'm trying to remember the name of the book so I could just give him a little shout out on this call. But I can't remember the name of the book. But it was all about Catholic writers versus lapsed Catholic writers versus non-religious writers. And it was actually a fascinating analysis of different writers, Flannery O'Connor, trying to think of some others off the top of my head, Ron Hanson, I'm trying to remember some of the others, but analyzed their work and talked about it in terms of, are they traditional, are they Catholic writers, or are they lapsed Catholic writers?
So I
really do think that I must fall in the classification of a lapsed Catholic writer, because I don't write about some of the traditional ritualized, almost mystical elements of the religion. I am very, very much a writer. I'm very, very much steeped in written word and finding the beauty in the written word in literature, as opposed too much too much emphasis on the ritualized sacramental aspects of the Catholic faith.
You know, speaking of Catholic writers, when I was probably an older teen and young adult, I read every book that Father Greeley wrote. Do you remember Father Andrew Greeley? Do you ever hear of him?
Oh, it's ringing a bell.
He wrote mysteries. He wrote mysteries. And they were, you know, all had a, he was a priest, and they all had a Catholic setting. And I loved those books.
I'm not sure if I ever read them. I mean, the name sounds so familiar, but I'm going to have to go back and look at
that.
Yeah,
and I don't know that I would like them now. You know, I'm
that's a good question.
From a very different perspective. In fact, I should get one and see.
And take a look.
Yeah.
Well, I have a confession to make. The mysteries that I read when I was a kid.
Let me guess.
Nancy Drew.
I knew you were going to say that. And I did too.
My younger sister and I were, you know, I think they were $1.25 per book when we were young. I'm giving away my age now. And my grandmother would take us to the store near her house when we would stay overnight at her house, and she would let us pick out something at the store. And my sister Barbara and I used to walk up and down in front of the Nancy Drew books trying to decide which one was she going to buy and which one was I going to buy so we could swap them.
Okay.
And we ended up with a huge collection of them. So, yeah, that was my big.
Well, I don't know that I actually owned many, if any. I just got them from the library. But, I'm pretty sure I read every single one. But I also read Hardy Boys because I had brothers. And so they would get the Hardy Boys books, and I'd read those too. And then there was Cherry Ames Student Nurse.
I read those.
Did you?
I loved those. I was so certain I was going to be an Army nurse someday. I just thought they were fabulous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. Those are the were the influences on, women of my generation. And
Well, I was going to mention the Mary Stuart novels were also fabulous. She wrote, just
historical
as an example,
fiction.
She wrote The Moon Spinners.
Yes, yes.
She wrote these adventure stories. And I remember The Moon Spinners because it was a Walt Disney movie with Hayley Mills. And she goes to this Greek island with her aunt, who is an anthropologist collecting folk music. And all these things influenced me through my life with my fascination with going other places and finding out how other people live. But you're right. Let's get back to
get back to only the women
we're
are
here
burning.
To talk about.
Yeah. Well, we talked about sisterhood. Now, another kind of problematic relationship that Cassandra has in this book is with her husband, who, you know, I gotta say, he's a bit of a jerk. He's a lot of a jerk.
Isn't he?
Through most of the book.
He's
yeah.
a lot of a jerk.
He's a lot of a jerk. I'm hoping that your husband was better than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, he was. He was better than that. You know, it's funny because I really wanted to highlight that whole idea of being silenced and how Cassandra struggled with that from different aspects of her life, not just as a professional woman. And so I had to decide how I was going to, you know, how I was going to develop Pete. And I probably exaggerated him to being a really big jerk, maybe a little bit more than I needed to, but I wanted it that way. I wanted it that way to highlight what she was trying to cope with in her life.
Well,
and
it wasn't that surprising to me that he was that big of a jerk. It was more surprising that she endured it for as long as she did and sort of overlooked it for as long as she did. That was,
yeah.
But that was part of her journey in the book was finding the strength to not overlook it anymore.
Yes. And recognizing that she was overlooking more than she realized she was overlooking.
Yeah.
And she does that. It's complex. You know, it's funny because when I talk to people about this book and what people have said to me about this book is, you have no idea what a deep dive this book takes into women's issues, women's lives, and all the different aspects of the relationships they have as they go through daughterhood, motherhood, wifehood, you know, and all of those phases. And there is one theme in this book that is Cassandra having blinders on to a certain extent, until she no longer has blinders on. Mm. And that idea runs through not only her marriage, but the mystery that she's trying to solve.
Ah, very interesting. I never really thought about that. You know, we're having such a great time talking. I almost forgot to ask you to read. So would you like to read from Only the Women
okay,
Are Burning?
Sure. Yes, I'm enjoying this conversation immensely. Okay, so I'm going to read from chapter one because that just seems to be the best starting point. Chapter one, Hillston, New Jersey. Friday started as an ordinary day, but that was before I failed to save Ann Neelam from burning to death. I stepped through the usual golden light filtering through the branches onto the blacktopped path through my park to the train. I greeted a squirrel poking out of a trash can with a chunk of someone's discarded bagel in its jaw. That station, with its quaint station house, its coffee window for busy commuters, its old wooden roof and neat platform, will never feel tranquil again. But that Friday, my girls were off to school. My coffee maker was shut off and unplugged. The front door was locked and closed into its frame. And I walked my usual 8 minutes to the station. I had a vague recognition that my life was so routine that I was entering a phase of middle age where habits and patterns would repeat endlessly and I would perish from my own boredom. My neighbors in their own routines were already aboard the Midtown Direct to their big jobs in New York, which stopped in Newark and would normally to their big jobs in New York. Which stopped in Newark and would normally drop me to my $12 an hour teaching job, visiting school groups at the museum. But not that morning. I never got on the train. They, however, watched from the windows while I tried to save her. That day should have been a happy acknowledgement of spring, I liked teaching the kids, and I got home before the school bus dropped Mia and Allie, my 8-year-old twins, at the corner. Before that day, it all worked. I stepped into line among the women in low heels, their confidence obvious in their posture, their preoccupation with watches or cell phones. Next to me, a blue-suited woman with a briefcase and purse, holding a cup of coffee up to her lips, tisked her tongue against her teeth and sighed. Her impatience, her gaze up the tracks, made me think she was waiting for someone or something more important and far more interesting than anything I expected. That hint, that sense that there is always something more than what I did every day, hovered there over me, and for an instant, I felt envy of her. She was waiting for something so important that she was impatient. I was always patient. Often I laughed and told other mothers that God first gave me patience, then he gave me Lila. I reached for the railing and lifted my foot. It was just then a wave of heat flowed over me like a hot flash. I turned and the heat burst into a pillar of flame, the ends of which gave off dark smoke like a phantom cloud forming in the shape of a demon. Waves of hot gaseous plasma hit me, a raging tower of yellow fire from exactly where the tisking woman had been. I can only now compare it to that feeling of time slowing when in a car you know a crash is unavoidable and you hear the metal crunching of impact. Terror knotted in my viscera. I expected the flame to roar and engulf me. Panic tasted like metal in my throat, and my heart's pounding mobilized me to flee. I turned back from 30 feet away and saw the flame had now pulled into itself and towered in a vertical column, and the woman was behind it, underneath it, inside it. My God, the woman in the blue suit was burning. My skin was felt singed. A hot, dry wind pushed my hair across my eyes, and I stood, my mind saying, help her, my heart saying, move before it leaps and ignites you. But I could not, frozen as I was in holy terror. Stop, drop, and roll is what they teach you in first aid class, but there was nothing to roll her in, and the flame was like a shield pushing everyone back. It was only me and the conductor and her, and I succumbed to a helplessness I'd felt only once before. This woman in the blue suit was burning to death. The conductor was at the station's ticket booth pulling a fire extinguisher from the wall. My CPR training as a Girl Scout leader screamed, first call for help, and I dug out my cell phone and dialed. The flames licked down her arms and legs while the voice of the female dispatcher came on. 911, what is your emergency? A fire, I said. A woman is on fire at the Hillston train station. A building, you say? No, a woman, no. She's waiting for the train. She's burning. My mind raced through what needed to happen. The calm voice dispatcher was too slow. Get them here to help her. Now, hurry, before she... My voice was deadpan. My words left me while my heart raced and sweat pooled in my palms. Is there a danger to anyone else? What? Yes. No, I don't know. The station has been called. They're on their way. Please hold. Hold. She put me on hold. Faces on the train through the windows stared. I could see the flame wasn't spreading to the train or the pillar holding up the roof or the conductor and me. It was just taking her. In that fraction of a second of knowing I would be unharmed, I was mesmerized by the flame. A roaring of it filled the air, the scent of burning hair, of flesh. My throat closed. I held my breath. Bonnie, had that nightmare followed me here? The flame was colorful, flecks of blue and green mingled with the yellow and orange dancing in the oxygen it consumed. Unlike Bonnie, who screamed and moaned, this woman hadn't moved under it, hadn't run and fallen over, hadn't waved her arms or screamed in pain. She simply succumbed, like a statue, a tree, like she was abdicating to a higher power.
Thank you, Nancy. That was Nancy Burke reading from Only the Women Are Burning.
I feel like I have written and rewritten and read this scene so often that I can feel like it almost really did happen.
Oh, I bet. So let's talk a little bit about your writing process. I know we talked about the amount of research you did. Did you have all that research and then you sat down to start actually writing the story, or were you doing both at the same time?
I was doing both at the same time. I wrote 5 whole drafts of this novel.
Wow.
And with each iteration, I would get to the end of it and I wasn't satisfied and I was just kind of floundering over what exactly was it that I wanted to say with this novel until finally, you know, I went through my MFA program. I started this book, the creative spark came to me before I did the MFA program. And then I entered the program and spent 2 years with that and focused on other work, because writing a novel while you're doing fiction workshops is difficult.
Hmm.
Bringing excerpts of a novel to a workshop and then listening to commentary from your fellow students when they don't know the whole picture makes it kind of not so helpful. So I put it away and I took it out probably in 2014 after I finished If I Could Paint the Moon Black. And I just, you know, I think my difficult part in this was so much research, and how was it all going to dovetail into one full satisfying conclusion? And at the same time, how was I going to make this believable in a realistic setting and use this fabulous element in everybody's hometown, basically?
And you're right. You know, you said at the beginning of our conversation that this is a cross-genre book, which in some ways makes it much more challenging, I would think.
It was a fun book to write, I will say that, because it gave me so many places for my imagination to just kind of go off on tangents, but I had to wrestle that imagination back under control at some point. I know that's too much, pull back. So I didn't know that it was a cross genre until I finished it and I had to go to literary agents to represent the book and ask them to represent it. And I really, really felt like it was a hard novel to introduce to the commercial fiction world, because you really do have to read it to really understand the subtext of the mystery and the fabulous elements. So it was shopped around to a lot of agents. It got rejected by a lot of agents. And I finally turned to small presses and found Apprentice House Press, which is they're actually part of Loyola University down in Baltimore. And it is part of the English department. They have a concentration for undergrads in publishing. And so the press is run by faculty and students who are getting their feet wet in the world of publishing. So when they offered me,
I had no idea.
They're absolutely a unique publisher. And at first, I was like, oh, do I want this small press? And do I want undergrads working on bringing my book out to the market? And then I said, you know, young minds are so fresh and so unencumbered by patterns and expectations that this is going to turn out to be a perfect marriage between this book and the undergrads who are going to work on it with me. And that is absolutely, in fact, what turned out to be the case.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, the fun part of it was when Taylor, who was my undergrad, who was in the book designing class and was assigned my book, she had read some of it. And I said, Taylor, you really have to read the whole book before you can do this cover. And so she emailed me a couple of days later. She said, I started your book. She says, now I don't want to do any of my my academic work, because all I want to do is curl up and finish your manuscript. So I was really, really pleased that a young girl who was 22 years old could get into my book, which was written by, you know, somebody who's my age. So that was exciting. And then I said to her one day, I said, Taylor, I want you to design an award-winning book cover, and I want it to be on my book. And so the two of us started exchanging images. We were just shopping around looking at book covers. And I sent her that outline of the woman who is, you know, the picture, the illustration that's on the cover of the book. And she told me this story. She said she was in her dorm room. This is before the, you know, all the students got sent home in March because of the pandemic. And I was playing around with Adobe Illustrator. And she said, all of a sudden, I let out this shout in the middle of the night. And I woke up my roommate who jumped off her bunk. And she said, what? And she showed her how she filled the outline of the woman in profile with the flame texture and color. And she knew
that
she had it.
Yeah.
In the middle of the night, she had it. And she sent it to me. And I was like, you did it, girl. Wow. So so Apprentice House Press did submit her to a contest for book cover. So I'm hoping that
it
would be fabulous if she won it. It would be fabulous, yeah.
Now, were your other books similar at all to Only the Women Are Burning, or were they much different?
They were very different. From the Abuela's Window was my first book. That was really written, I would say that was written for my children and their friends, because my children were the ages of those characters when I wrote the book. I was really, really fascinated by magic realism, and I wanted to do something with magic realism, but have it take place somewhere familiar. But I realized I had to place this book in South America because that was the birthplace of magic realism through Gabriel Garcia Marquez's work. And at the time, I just kind of looked around and found the country of Chile and the Pinochet military dictatorship and takeover of the country back in the early 1970s. And I said, this is the perfect backdrop to tell this magic realism story about this young girl whose father is among the disappeared, who were basically, you know, people who were kidnapped by the government and were never seen again in Chile during that takeover. It just served as a perfect, like, political and social backdrop for the story of a little girl who is given a magic bicycle by the abuelas, who are the three little old ladies who live next door to her in her village. And how this girl uses that magic bike to basically pay it forward and help another family who has is facing the same thing she's facing with her father disappeared. So that was kind of, yeah, that was designed to bring some enlightenment to American, you know, school children in the middle grade ages and young adult ages to say, look, you know, we are a country of immigrants. And here is one of the reasons why people from other countries flee their country and come to the United States. And that was really what that book was all about.
Okay, and if I could paint the moon black?
Well, I had just finished From the Abuela's Window. I was looking for another story, and my next-door neighbor invited me to the screening of a film called The Singing Revolution about the country of Estonia and how they rid themselves of the Soviets finally in the 1990s. And there was a woman there who got up and told her story at the end of the screening of the movie. She was a child in Estonia during World War II. And she got up to tell the story of how her family, she and her mother, escaped from the Soviet takeover of her country into Nazi-occupied land in Eastern Europe. And I sat up in that audience and I said, wait a minute. We learn about that period in history as the Germans as the bad guys, which they obviously were, but the Soviets, who were our allies in that war, were just as bad or worse. And what Tom Snyder from Harvard University calls the bloodlands of Eastern Europe. So Imbi Pibo Trumies is the woman who got up and told her story. And I went up to her at the end of the event and I said, somebody needs to write your story. And she looked at me, she thanked me and thought it was a compliment. And, you know, she went home and I went home. And then I called my neighbor and I said, you need to put me in touch with her because I have to write her story. And we did. And we met for several years where I would go to her house and I would sit in her living room and she would serve me little morsels of goodies and she would talk and I would write. And I figured out how to get that into book form.
Wow. And so you've done quite a few plays as well.
Well, I have two plays.
Two plays.
They're short
okay.
plays.
Okay.
Two short 10-minute plays. And I haven't really written any long plays because I've just kind of zeroed in on fiction. But I had a period of time when I was still married that my father-in-law became ill and he came to live with us. And I became his caregiver. And he used to sit in my kitchen and tell me stories. And my two plays are based on stories he told me about his, well, one of them is based on his experience as a young Seabee on Midway Island during World War II.
Oh, wow.
And how he was kind of like a cantankerous young man who was not very happy following orders of his commanding officers. And so he got thrown in the brig once and they threw him in with a Japanese pilot prisoner who they had rescued from the ocean. And one of my short plays is the story of him and the Japanese prisoner sitting in that cell together.
Oh, fascinating.
And I'll leave it. And
wow.
I'll leave it at that. And the other play was called Make Yourself at Home. And it is about him taking over the house when he lived with us and my daughter coming home from school in the afternoons to have to practice her piano and having grandpa blasting the TV in the living room and not agreeing to go upstairs to his bedroom where he had a nice comfy chair and his own TV because he didn't want the kids telling the grandpa what to do. So that was a comedy. I wrote that one as a comedy.
Well, real quick, because we're just about out of time, what are you working on now?
Well, two things. I'm mulling over the idea of bringing Cassandra back in another Cassandra Taylor mystery.
Very good. Yes, definitely.
Might that be great? Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of have the idea for the mystery kind of trying to formulate itself in the back of my mind.
Wow.
And then my other project is a collection of short stories that I'm calling Units of Measure. And it's just based on the question of how do people measure their success, their happiness, and the culmination of their lives on Earth? And what do they use? And how do they look at themselves and, you know, kind of decide whether they feel like they've been a success or not. Money,
love,
whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Friends,
legacy.
You know, whatever.
Yeah.
Legacy.
Yeah.
So I'm playing around with the people in my own life as possible characters for this. So all the names will be changed to protect the innocent.
Or the guilty, as the case may be. Well,
thank
you so much for being with us, Nancy. It was a real pleasure.
Oh, it was my pleasure, definitely. Thank you so much for having me.
And we always close with a quote. Usually my mom comes up with that, but since she's not here, I'm going to pick one that is a chapter heading in your book. There may be a great fire in our soul, yet no one ever comes to warm himself at it, and the passersby see only a wisp of smoke. And that was from Vincent van Gogh, who wasn't known for being a bright, cheery fellow.
That's wonderful.
So thank you again, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices. Bye.